Your Honor, plaintiffs call Mr. Peter Erickson. Your Honor, for purposes of Mr. Erickson's testimony, I'll be referencing exhibits P-192, his CV, P-310, the references cited from his expert report, P-214, the attachment 2 to Mr. Erickson's expert report, P-92, a page of a website, P-150, a air quality permit, and P-121, a document headed final guidance for federal departments and agencies on consideration of greenhouse gas emissions. And I've provided counsel with the base numbers of these. And finally, Your Honor, attachment 2 to Mr. Erickson's expert report, exhibit P-214, references another a group of exhibits, which at the appropriate point I'll identify because they're lengthy, but in essence, P-264 through P-301. Please state your name for the record.
Hello, it's Peter Erickson.
Can you spell your name?
Yes, P-E-T-E-R-E-R-I-C-K-S-O-N.
Where do you live?
Seattle, Washington.
Have you been asked by the plaintiffs to serve as an expert on certain topics in this case?
Yes, I have.
Can you briefly describe those topics?
Yes, the central topic that I have been asked to opine and present on is Montana's fossil fuel economy, the coal, oil, and gas that have been produced and consumed and transmitted and processed in the state, and the CO2 emissions that result from all of those fuels. So that's a bunch of research and a bunch of math. I've also been asked to provide some opinions to rebut or comment on the expert reports of Drs. Judith Curry and Dr. Terry Anderson.
And can you give us a general description of the opinions you intend to offer in rebuttal to Drs. Curry and Anderson?
Yes, I expect we'll get more into this, but in general, I believe that Drs. Curry and Anderson misrepresent the state of Montana's emissions, and they misrepresent the state of global cooperation among governments to reduce those emissions.
And we've marked as exhibit P-192 a copy of your CV. Is that a true and correct copy of your CV?
I don't believe I have a binder in front of me.
Okay. Can you hang on one second? Excuse me, Your Honor.
Yeah.
May I approach the witness, Your Honor?
Yeah.
And Mr. Erickson, we're talking about P-192.
I see that now, and yes, that is correct.
Your Honor, I'd move exhibit P-192, Mr. Erickson's CV into evidence.
No objection.
P-192 is admitted.
Briefly, can you provide the court with your educational background?
Of course. I graduated from Carleton College in Minnesota in 1998, where my major field of study was geology. I also took extensive coursework in mathematics. In 2007, I went back to school to take a couple courses in economics, and that is my educational background.
Can you briefly describe your work history?
Yes. For the last over 20 years, I have been essentially a technical expert on environmental policy and climate policy. So the first part of my career was at a consulting firm on these topics. And then for the last 15 years, I've been at a nonprofit research institute where my sole focus has been on climate change and greenhouse gas emissions.
What's the name of that institute?
The Stockholm Environment Institute, or I may refer to it as SEI.
And is that affiliated with Tufts University?
It is. It's an international research institute, but in the United States, it's a 501c3 nonprofit associated with Tufts University.
And does SEI do original research?
Yes, that's our focus.
Can you give us a little bit more information about what the focus of your research has been?
Sure. Yeah. The big focus, the main focus of my research has been on greenhouse gas accounting and on assessing policies and measures and actions that governments take to either increase or decrease greenhouse gas emissions. So in the course of that work, I've had the chance to work with many partners, many clients, many other institutions, such as the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. That's the sort of administrative body through which governments of the world collaborate on climate change plans and policies, European Commission, World Bank, US EPA, Bloomberg Philanthropies, Energy Foundation, number of foundations, really, US states of Washington and Oregon, Western Climate Initiative, and number of cities like Seattle, Chicago, Los Angeles.
Have you authored scientific peer-reviewed studies?
Yes, a number of them. That's one of the main parts of my job as a scientist, is to do that, to both contribute as a scientist to the peer-reviewed literature, but also to serve as a reviewer for those scientific publications. So I've had first author research articles in Nature, which is the most widely regarded scientific journal in the world, some of its sub-journals called Nature Climate Change, Nature Energy, Climatic Change, Climate Policy, Energy Policy, Environmental Research Letters, Environmental Science and Technology. There are others, but stop there.
Okay. And we're displaying three of your papers. Can you, again, briefly describe the titles and the topics by these papers?
Of course. And I picked these because I think they relate in some way to the matters at hand today. So I'm going to focus on the ones on the outside of this slide, the first and the third. One is called Effect of Subsidies to Fossil Fuel Companies on United States Crude Oil Production. That was in a journal called Nature Energy. And then another one called Why Fossil Fuel Producer Subsidies Matter. That was in a journal called Nature. Those two articles incidentally helped form the policy. Leasing there means the federal government leasing lands and waters for fossil fuel extraction. This article, it ended up having much more interest than I ever imagined. It was cited directly, and I was cited directly by three different federal courts. I believe that was the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, an Alaska District Court, and a D.C. District Court, all with regards to this issue of calculating CO2 emissions associated with lands, with fossil fuel extraction. And those courts essentially said, hey, Department of Interior, you didn't do what Erickson did. You should do what Erickson did.
Now, have you testified as an expert in court?
Yes.
Can you briefly describe that case?
I testified in a case in Tacoma, Washington, about the greenhouse gas accounting associated with a proposed liquefied natural gas, or LNG, terminal.
Did you do any work on the recent IPCC Sixth Assessment Report?
I was invited to be a reviewer, an expert reviewer of some of the chapters that deal with greenhouse gas emission reduction scenarios and plans by countries. The authors of those chapters reached out to me and asked me to be an expert reviewer through that official process to provide comment and suggestions on those chapters.
Is that in essence what we've heard about a lot in this case, being like a peer reviewer?
Indeed, yes.
And are you working on a paper right now?
I am. I'm working on a paper with many of those IPCC authors that looks at the science and economics, really, of how quickly coal, oil, and gas need to be ramped down over time globally in order to stay within globally agreed climate limits.
Have you served on any committees regarding greenhouse gas accounting?
Yes, a couple. Committees, as you said, focused on the accounting, on the technical details and best practices for how to measure emissions. One of those was, and I should say, both of those are stakeholder-driven expert processes. You gather a whole bunch of people from around the world. You get them together to sort out these details. So I was on those committees. One of them was sponsored by the International Council of Local Environmental Initiatives, or really they go by ICLEI, the acronym. And that one was to create the standard, the rules, if you will, on how to do greenhouse gas accounting at a, what they called a community scale. So cities, counties, but, you know, potentially states. The other committee was by the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, again, another international body that gathers experts. This one was for something called the Greenhouse Gas Mitigation Goals Standard. I think it was yesterday we heard about, no, it was this morning, excuse me, we heard from Ms. Hedges about a previous effort in Montana to set a goal for what its emission reductions might be over time. There are some technical details that go into setting a goal like that. So this standard was to be used by states, by provinces in Canada, by nations, any sort of jurisdictional entity that was wanting to set a greenhouse gas reduction goal.
So there are standards for greenhouse gas emissions accounting.
Yeah, absolutely. There have long been standards. There are a number of them, and it really depends what standard applies. It depends on what context is being considered.
And your CV reflects some international presentations that you've given. Have you given presentations around the world?
Yes, on all these topics. It's a global community of researchers and policy analysts that work on this, and I've presented to many of those fora, shall we say.
Are you charging the youth plaintiffs in this case for your time serving as an expert witness?
No.
Why not?
My understanding of their financial situation.
Now, we've heard and seen a lot of pictures of Glacier National Park. What does the state of Montana have to do with you becoming involved in this climate work?
Goes back a while to 1990, but that's when I first visited Glacier National Park with my family on a, you know, classic American road trip. And there was an exhibit about glacier recession and climate change and global warming back there in 1990. And they, you know, were predicting what glacier recession might be like. And I think we've heard about that. Anyway, that, I think I finished my thought there. That contributed to me wanting to work on this professionally.
I see you've got a contraption on your wrist. What happened?
Yeah, sorry. I broke my wrist. Was supposed to have surgery today, but we'll have it next Thursday instead back in Seattle.
So you are here today rather than having surgery.
You can say that. It is more fun.
In preparing for your testimony in this case, did you consult any published material?
A whole bunch of it. A bunch of reports. I'll just say most of them were from the U.S. Department of Energy and from Montana state agencies. So both reports and data sources. Thankfully, I found that there's a lot of synergy between the Montana state agencies and the U.S. government reports. A lot of Montana agencies use data from the United States Department of Energy. So that was a bit of a relief. I also looked at statutes and permits issued by the defendant agencies in this case related to fossil fuels. I surveyed the peer-reviewed literature about fossil fuel exploration and development. And I looked at the latest reports on climate science and climate change mitigation from Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for example.
If you look in your binder, we've marked as Exhibit 310 the references cited by Mr. Erickson in his expert report. Are these your references?
Yes, sir. It looks like there's about 63 references there that were that I made.
And, Your Honor, I'd move Exhibit 310 into evidence.
No objection.
310 is submitted.
Among matters you've relied on, did you review the expert report of Ms. Hedges and attend court this morning when Ms. Hedges testified?
I did.
And generally, what did you look at that material for?
I guess you could say I looked at that material to validate and extend my own research. So I first did research from Montana state agencies about their permitting practices, for example, on fossil fuels. But obviously Ms. Hedges is a much deeper expert on that. So then I looked at her report to, you know, essentially validate that I had been seeing on my own.
And Mr. Erickson, did you also review the expert work of Drs. Steve Running and Kathy Whitlock on areas such as the IPCC reports and the climate assessments for Montana?
Yes.
Mr. Erickson, were all the opinions expressed in your expert disclosures in this case based on a reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
Yes.
Will you please answer my questions today with applying that same standard, a reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
Of course.
Okay. Can you describe the three categories of activities you looked at, fossil fuel consumption, extraction, and transportation and processing?
Of course. And this is an important thing to just get clear on at the beginning, because this is going to carry through my testimony today. Fossil fuel analysts, or really climate accountants, you could say, when it comes to fossil fuels, they think of what could be termed the full life cycle of fossil fuels. And by that, I mean fossil fuels are extracted from the earth first, right? Then they're moved somewhere. They may experience some additional processing, and then they end up at their final destination, where they're burned, consumed, combusted for energy. So three basic phases to that life cycle: extraction, and then transport and processing sort of bundled together, and then final consumption. So most of the estimates, the math, the CO2 estimates I present today are going to address all three of these categories, although I'll do that in turn so that we can be clear each time just what we're talking about.
And to a certain extent, do these three categories interact with one another?
Yes, absolutely. We've heard about the Colstrip power plant and the Rosebud mine earlier today. Clearly, the same lump of coal is pulled out of the Rosebud mine as it gets burned in the Colstrip plant. So I take into account for any of those overlaps in any sort of adding up that I do.
And can you briefly describe what I'm going to call the methodology you use to quantify each category?
It's basically just simple carbon accounting. You could call it slightly different things for each category, but the basic method I go through has been used by governments for decades, and we can get into that a little bit more. Yeah, so it's always risky to bring equations into a courtroom, but I think we can handle this one, and I want to, because it's important. This is the bedrock of carbon dioxide emissions accounting, this equation. So let's spend a little time with each of the terms. And again, this basic principle that has been, you know, in Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change guidance on doing greenhouse gas inventories for a long, long time. So this is completely uncontroversial. So start with the quantity of fossil fuels that you're considering, right? And that might be tons of coal or barrels of oil or cubic feet of gas, or you could have in energy terms if you wanted to, not just physical terms. The next term in this equation is, well, how much carbon is in it, right? We're talking about carbon dioxide, literally. How much carbon is in that ton of coal, you know, in percent terms, or in grams of carbon per ton of coal, for example. you know, you get where I'm going. Then there's this sort of cute, I think, little correction or scaling factor to turn carbon into CO2, because that's what happens when fossil fuel is burned. It's quite simple. The energy that comes from fossil fuels comes from these bonds being broken, and the carbon molecule gets two oxygen molecules glommed onto it, and then it's a bigger molecule. So the weight of a piece of CO2 is 44 compared to the weight of a piece of just carbon is 12. That's sort of from basic chemistry. And then the last number is, well, how much of that was actually burned, by the way? Because if some of that fuel was not actually burned, then we can't count it as CO2, right? If it drips out of the gasoline out of the end of the tailpipe or something like that, then, you know, we wouldn't want to count it. It might be bad for other reasons, but it's not CO2.
And so this, generally, the slide we are calling CO2 emissions accounting, that's generally the formula you employed for purposes of this case.
Yes, absolutely. And then, you know, the other arc to the accounting is just which category does that CO2 fit in? Is it the extraction? Is it the transportation? Is it the consumption?
And is there any difference between what I'm going to call fossil fuels extracted versus fossil fuels consumed for purposes of this equation?
Oh, yes. And thank you for asking that. So that difference really focuses on this last term percentage combusted, because it's generally the case, say, for a ton of coal at a power plant, that all of it is combusted. So U.S., you know, inventory guidance will generally say, assume 100% combustion at, you know, big stationary sources of emissions. However, for this extraction piece, when I'm estimating how much emissions are associated with a ton of coal mined in Montana or a barrel of oil extracted from Montana, it would be presumptuous perhaps to assume that all of that ends up getting burned, right? Because it might go to other uses. Some of that oil might be made into plastics that then goes back into the landfill and isn't ever released to CO2. So this percentage combusted term varies according to those three different lenses. For example, if I may, crude oil, the peer reviewed studies that I've looked at show that about, you know, 8%, say, of an average barrel of oil ends up going into other uses that aren't CO2. So I would use a lower, you know, percent combusted for crude oil extracted than I would for, you know, a liquid fuel burned in a car or a truck.
And what about coal? What's the percentage?
Yeah, for coal, it's very minor. I mean, a small amount of coal goes to uses other than combustion.
And is there a term used for estimating the emissions associated with extraction?
Yes, there is. The accounting associated with carbon in fossil fuels that are extracted is perhaps unsurprisingly called extraction-based emissions accounting. Some of the scientific studies call it physical carbon accounting. I kind of like that too, but I'm going to call it extraction-based accounting today just because it's more common. So it's that type of accounting that I use for the fossil fuel extraction and then also for the transport and processing steps. And really the only difference is that I assume that less of that fuel ends up getting burned, as I said a few minutes ago.
And is the method you use similar to the method used by the U.S. Department of Interior, for example, for fossil fuels extracted on federal lands?
Absolutely. So in the last few years, the U.S. Department of Interior has published a website that shows the, let's call it, extraction-based emissions associated with all of the fossil fuels extracted from federal lands. They have, you know, some extra details that they get into, but the basic method is just what I'm showing here on the screen. The basic concept is the same.
And let's look at another diagram.
Okay.
You prepared to, I'm going to call it, we started off describing the three categories. Can you get into a little bit more depth on those?
Absolutely. I probably should have given more examples earlier. So this is, you might call it a Venn diagram with an extra circle, that shows conceptually what kinds of activities fit in these three different categories that I'm talking about. And also it shows the overlaps. So over there in the right are fossil fuels extracted in Montana. So that would include, you know, for example, coal that's mined in Montana, but then sent elsewhere, sent to other states, sent to other countries. On the left, fossil fuels consumed in Montana, that would include gasoline and diesel in cars and trucks that people may have driven here today. It would include natural gas in to heat our homes, for example. There's this overlap, again, that we mentioned, like the best example is coal extracted at Rosebud, burned a coal strip. And then there's this other category of fossil fuels transported through Montana. These are fossil fuels that come in and then maybe they get processed in Montana, or maybe they just go right through, but then they leave the state again without being used here. So those are the three main categories. And
And can you give us some examples of that third category?
Oh, yes. The biggest, we'll get into the numbers, but the biggest part of that category is oil that comes in on pipelines from Canada and then crosses the state and goes to Wyoming, either as crude oil still or after being refined, especially at the refineries in the Billings area.
And we're going to start getting into what I'm going to call numbers. And is there a year that you used for the numbers you're going to present today?
They are numbers, and they're for the year 2019.
Why that year?
That was the latest year for which comprehensive data were available for all of these categories that are on the screen, all three of the categories, at the time that I did my calculations.
So have we covered your diagram about the categories?
I think so, but I'm sure we can come back to it.
Okay. So you've showed us your equation. You've showed us your categories. Now let's start getting into the numbers.
Great. So let's start with fossil fuels extracted in Montana. So this is coal at the coal mines and some oil and some gas. And all of that in the year 2019, once combusted, again, wherever it ended up, 70 million tons of carbon dioxide.
And then what about the next category?
Yes. So fossil fuels consumed in Montana. Remember, this is the cars and trucks and coal-fired power plants and natural gas in homes. 32 million tons. These are the fossil fuels consumed in Montana. And I just want to note here that this definition, this lens, this category is really just about identical to what Montana and other states have already, you know, they already consider. So when we heard about Montana's greenhouse gas inventory this morning from 2007, where we heard about the Montana Climate Solutions Council looking at emissions, this definition is lockstep with what they look at, and the numbers agree. And then the third category is this fossil fuel transport through and refined in Montana. And this is at least 80 million tons. The data here are not as completely available, but at least 80 million tons of worth of fossil fuels. Let me make sure I say this completely precisely. So fossil fuels that are coming into Montana and then leaving again without being combusted in state. Once those are combusted, that is 80 million tons of carbon dioxide, again, in the year 2019.
And then earlier you briefly alluded to the concept of overlap. Can you explain that a little bit here?
Yes. So in a minute, we're going to add these numbers up. But it's not a simple arithmetic of adding those 32, that 70, and that 80 because there's this overlap. So I take out that overlap so that nothing ends up being double counted.
And so what's the number you ultimately came to for the categories of fossil fuel activities in Montana?
Yes, the number I came to was 166 million tons of carbon dioxide in 2019.
Have you developed what I'm going to call another slide to depict, in essence, the same 166 million number?
Yes, I like charts, and I like trying different charts that different audiences may resonate more with. So this shows the 166 million broken down, depicted in a different way. These gray arrows that are shown in this chart, those represent, on the right hand side, fossil fuels coming into the state. But that doesn't, it's the right hand side. It doesn't just mean they come in from the east. It's just conceptual. the fossil fuels coming into the state on the right-hand side, on the far left, not the west, fossil fuels leaving the state as exports. Okay. Now, in the lower right, and this is perhaps coincidentally or maybe on purpose, extraction coming up from within Montana. So there's this arrow sort of coming up and joining the economy. And it's a big arrow. And that is coal that's extracted from Montana. And much of that coal is actually in southeastern Montana. So there we go. Let me say, make one more conceptual point before I go into any details. And that is just that the difference between imports and exports is essentially what stays in the state and is consumed. So those little arrows over there on the left by consumption, those are the emissions rising up, just like the arrow points up from within the state.
And essentially, what I want to point out here and ask you about is the numbers on this slide, 28, 37, 23, and 78, they're different from the numbers in the prior slide. Can you explain the difference?
Yeah, of course. The 166 is the same. It's just a matter of how you slice that up. And this Venn diagram chart, I'm presenting the numbers according to the three steps in the life cycle, the three different lenses that I'm looking at. Whereas in the flow chart slide, I'm presenting the numbers in terms of the fossil fuels. Although I'll note that the size of those arrows, again, is proportional to the numbers that we saw on the previous by life cycle phase.
And in this, what I'm going to call the second depiction, the one headed annual impact of Montana's fossil fuel economy, did you also address overlap?
Yes, I did. Yeah. And I mean, one reason I like this depiction, is it really shows in visual terms how Montana is a thoroughfare for fossil fuels, right? Like the size of the emissions in the state here is not as big as the fossil fuels coming in and leaving. They're all big quantities on their own. And then in some, they're 166.
And for whether we talk about the categories slide or this slide, are there sources of emissions that you have not considered in making your calculations?
Yes, I only am looking at carbon dioxide associated with combusting these fuels. Other types of greenhouse gases are also really important and are associated with fossil fuels. So most prominently, methane, which is CH4. Methane is the main component of natural gas, for example. So at least 90% of natural gas is methane. Each gram of methane is about 30 times as potent in terms of warming in the atmosphere as a gram of carbon dioxide. So any methane, any natural gas that leaks on its way from the field to someone's home, it really increases the overall emissions associated with the fossil fuel economy. I wasn't asked to go into that level of detail for this report, but had I, it would increase all these numbers by a non-trivial amount.
And so in your view of the work you did here to reach the 166 million figure, do you believe you've overestimated or that you're, I'm going to call it on the conservative side? And if so, why?
Yeah, I mean, I believe strongly it's on the conservative side simply because it only is looking at CO2. There are other gases and other processes associated with fossil fuels that I didn't look at that would increase that total.
So again, let's go back and put the numbers in context with the categories. Let's start with extraction. Can you explain generally what you mean by extraction in Montana? I'm just going to go back here.
Sure. So this is coal, and oil and gas that are extracted within the state borders. It's mainly coal that represents that figure.
And in terms of Montana's extraction number areas of the world, how does that compare?
Yeah, here, and we're going to have a number of comparisons that we're going to make over the next few minutes, I think. But here, I like to think about the United Kingdom. And the reason is that most of the 70 million tons is coal. The modern coal industry coal for energy really began in the United Kingdom 150 years ago. About 30 million tons, sorry for the extra numbers, but about 30 million tons of coal are extracted in Montana every year. That's most of that 70 million tons of CO2. The UK last extracted 30 million tons of coal 20 years ago. They now extract 2 million tons of coal per year. So Montana dwarfs the nation that really was the founding of the modern coal for energy movement.
And let's turn from extraction to consumption. Can you explain consumption?
Yeah, so consumption, again, is fossil fuels burned in Montana for energy at vehicles and power plants and homes and buildings and factories and refineries. 32 million tons. That's quite similar to many other nations. It's actually more than 100 individual countries. But here I'm just going to call out a country that's very similar to Montana in its emissions, Ireland. 34 million tons in 2019. Population more than six times greater, however.
So the population of Ireland compared to the 34 million tons consumed is pretty comparable.
Except from a population standpoint, right. It shows that Montana's economy is much more carbon intensive just from that consumption perspective, from that energy use perspective than is Ireland's on a per person basis.
And can we turn now to transportation and processing?
Of course. So here, the figure I came up with was, again, 80 million tons. I'm going to compare that to the emissions arising from within Colombia, just to give a sense of scale. So the country of Colombia each year emits 75 million tons of CO2. I say each year, I really mean 2019 here. So very similar amount of emissions, but you can see, you know, many times the population. So Montana is, what we're seeing here is Montana is a very disproportionately large contributor to CO2 emissions relative to its population, from a number of different perspectives.
You earlier used the term thoroughfare. Typically what fossil fuel is transported via the thoroughfare.
Yeah. The thoroughfare is especially pipelines and oil and products that are made from oil.
And in your view, for purposes of this category, fossil fuel transportation and processing, does Montana have an important role in that category?
Oh, I mean, without a doubt, like not just this number on the screen, but Montana is really, at a linchpin of fossil fuel economy in Western North America. It's enabling oil from Western Canada to get to refineries both in Montana and beyond. Coal is traversing the state on trains. Crude oil is moving across the state in trains. Much of the West's fossil fuel supplies flow through Montana.
So let's see about CO2 emissions associated with Montana's economy using the 166 million tons per year figure. Have you compared that to other countries?
Yeah, again, so here's, this is that 166 total. That's all three categories added together minus overlaps. That is equivalent to roughly equivalent to the emissions in 2019 of these three different countries. And again, those emissions for those countries are just the emissions coming up from within the borders, just to be clear. But Argentina with 47 million people, Netherlands with 18 million people, Pakistan with 248 million people. So you see, again, just on a global scale, how emissions intensive Montana's economy is.
And you've given us a sense of the scale. Does that matter?
Yes, absolutely matters. And both in absolute, that 166, as well as because Montana is so much more carbon intensive than much of the rest of the world.
Now, again, let's turn to your understanding of the role defendants play in authorizing fossil fuel activities. Do the defendants in this case play a role in these significant quantities of CO2 emissions?
They do, yes.
How so?
They, in my understanding, the defendant agencies issue permits, for example, for much of the type of infrastructure and facilities that I've been talking about so far. There are also, numerous plans and policies that state agencies regularly do or regularly could do that affect whether a state's energy system moves towards or away from fossil fuels.
And have you viewed some of the permits issued by defendants?
Yes, a number of them.
And are permit documents publicly available?
Yes.
We marked as Exhibit P92, it's essentially a DEQ website, air quality permits issued. Can you generally explain that website?
Sure. That's a website that anybody can go to where you can look up. Here I have pulled up the air quality permits, for example, that have been issued by DEQ to not just, but in this case, the focus is on fossil fuel facilities.
And why is it important for you to review the permit information like this in developing your conclusions?
Good question. Because I am quantifying all of these emissions associated with Montana's energy economy, it's important. And for that to be relevant to this case, right, it's important for me to understand that indeed Montana state agencies have some agency or control or influence or decision-making power over these sources. So I'm clearly not the expert that Ms. Hedges is in this regard, but as an analyst, it was important to me to sort of, you could call it due diligence, to understand that causal chain of decision making.
And does that also apply to what I'm going to call the transportation and processing side?
Oh, yes. My understanding is there are permits given for each of the three categories.
So including the consumption side as well?
Yes.
Now, Mr. Erickson, if you turn to Exhibit P214, and that's attachment two to your expert report. Do you see that?
I do.
Okay. And does this Exhibit P214 contain permits you reviewed in connection with your work on this case?
Yes, this is a list of permits that I reviewed.
And how did you use these permits generally for preparing for your testimony today?
This set of permits was one of the sources I used to, I guess, again, help me understand that there was this chain of decision making between Montana state agencies and the different categories of emissions that I looked at under both extraction, transport and processing, and consumption.
And the permits reflected on attachment two, do you consider the information in these permits to be reliable?
Yes.
And to your knowledge, are all the permits on attachment two publicly available?
I believe so.
Okay. And permits such as on exhibit 214, are these data sources that scientists such as you rely on to do the accounting work you did in this case?
In this case, I would say generally that's true. Outside of this case, you know, there could be specific instances where permit documents are even more useful in the sense that they might specify how much fossil fuel is going to be handled or what the emissions are. And in that case, researchers, in preparing assessments of individual projects might use permits as well.
And Your Honor, I represent to the court that what we've marked in the exhibit list as exhibits P264 through 301 are the permits on attachment two that Mr. Erickson's just been referencing. In the course of your reviewing these permits, what'd you learn?
I guess in a general sense that the state of Montana issues permits for these fossil fuel activities, and that it continues to do so. I mean, when I go to that DEQ, for example, website, permits are still being given for fossil fuel activities.
And how would you respond to the hypothetical question that if fossil fuels were not extracted in Montana, in other words, there were no permits that were issued and fossil fuels weren't extracted, that the fossil fuel would just be substituted by fossil fuel extracted someplace else?
Yeah, this is a very deep area of my expertise. I've done a lot of peer-reviewed work on that, and it's simply not true that if one jurisdiction doesn't extract some fossil fuel that some other jurisdiction will, one for one. I mean, take coal, for example, which is, you know, one of the major fossil fuels extracted in Montana. People are buying Montana coal from, you know, as far away as Asia for some reason. If they can't get Montana coal, it's not necessarily the case that they just have another source sitting there waiting for them.
And in essence, is that a matter of economics?
Economics, infrastructure. Yes, fossil fuel systems are all connected, But it's not the case that they're so perfectly connected and so frictionless that there's just fossil fuels everywhere waiting to be extracted and sold, right? There is a relationship between supply and demand. That is basic economics, and that has been upheld in numerous scientific publications as well as by the courts.
And is that a concept called perfect substitution?
Yes, you could say that this idea of perfect substitution, that if we don't extract it or if Montana doesn't extract it, someone else just will, that has been rejected.
So we've talked about how Montana compares to emissions on a global scale, but let's talk about how Montana compares to the rest of the United States. We have a slide here headed per capita energy related CO2 emissions by state 2019. Can you explain this slide?
Sure. These are data directly from the U.S. Department of Energy, Energy Information Administration, or EIA, as I think I've called them before. Again, for the year 2019, just so we're using consistent data. And you'll see Montana there is the sixth highest emitter in terms of CO2 per person being a resident of Montana. So 30 tons of CO2 per person, you know, many times the global average, but here also much higher than, what would that be? 44 U.S. states, with only Wyoming, North Dakota, West Virginia, Alaska, and Louisiana being higher.
And again, this is only the number we're looking at here is simply the 30 of the 166.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying. This is only about those emissions about what is burned within Montana. So these are the same kind of emissions that Montana has already measured and counted themselves.
And does this, the data in this slide, lead you to believe that Montana's contribution to U.S. emissions is significant?
It is significant. It's disproportionately large given Montana's population.
Let's talk about CO2 extracted from fossil fuels extracted in Montana. And this slide we have before us uses the time frame 1960 to 2019. Can you walk us through this slide, please?
Sure. And the point of this slide is really mainly to add the time dimension and the cumulative picture of what we've already been talking about. So this is CO2 from fossil fuels extracted in Montana over several decades. 2019 number is 70, just as we've already said. But you can see that it's been about that high since the mid to late 70s, right? It ramped up very quickly over the course of the 70s, mainly coal. And though natural gas and especially crude oil were slowly declining through the early 2000s, the innovation and development of hydraulic fracturing or fracking technology really has led to a resurgence of oil and gas production in the mid-2000s. And I think it remains to be seen how durable that is. But nonetheless, like, Montana's emissions from fossil fuels extracted have been high for decades and will continue to be.
And Montana's constitution was ratified in the 1972 timeframe. What happened to CO2 from fossil fuels extracted after the Constitution was ratified?
Well, as you can see on this chart, it was already starting to increase, but then it increased even more rapidly in, five or so years after the Constitution.
And has it returned to anything close to the numbers of the time the Constitution was ratified?
No, I mean, right now it's 70. At that time, it was less than 30.
Let's look at fossil fuels, CO2 from fossil fuels consumed in Montana for the same time frame, 1960 to 2019.
Sir, if I may I make one final point about the last slide that I neglected to make?
Sure.
This is about the cumulative emissions associated with fossil fuels extraction. And the importance of cumulative emissions is just that because CO2 is such a long-lived pollutant in the atmosphere, it's cumulative CO2 that determines our amount of warming. And so, you know, that the fact that it's been 70 million tons or so, I mean, going up and down for so long, that adds up to 3.7 billion metric tons since 1960 is notable, just because that's actually the fuller picture than what happens in any given year.
So in other words, you don't look at a year to year and say CO2 that year, that's all that matters. Is that what you're saying?
You could say that.
And now let's... Ready for the next slide?
Yes.
And so again, what's, can you, describe what's depicted on this slide headed CO2 from fossil fuels consumed in Montana, 1960 to 2019?
Yes. So this is an analogous chart that I made for that consumption lens. The last slide was the extraction lens. So these are, fuels burned in Montana. Again, coal dominates, but we see oil, or more specifically, diesel and gasoline that are made from oil being larger contributors as well. And in fact, the fastest growing category is natural gas, as there have been natural gas power plants, built and many and others proposed, and as natural gas has been used in industry, in a growing amount.
Let's talk about extraction activities you've testified about. Where's the coal in? Oh, I'm sorry. Where's the coal in Montana been extracted from?
Yeah, so we just talked about sort of the time dimension, and now let's talk about a bit about where these activities take place. So as we saw, I think this exact same map earlier, just to indicate where these mines are. Many of them are in the southeastern portion of the state. Spring Creek Mine, Rosebud Mine, Decker Mine, Absaloka Mine. Bull Mountain Mine is over there in north and west a little bit. Savage Mine, I think we heard that that's closing, but nonetheless, it's been a mine over time.
Have all these mines received permits from the defendants?
Yes.
And have you reviewed some of these permits and preparing for your testimony today?
Yes.
And in all the, is all the coal that the state permits to be mined consumed in Montana?
No, most of it is sent out of state.
Earlier we discussed extraction of oil and gas. Now we're shifting from coal to oil and gas.
Okay.
Can you generally describe where this oil and gas is extracted from in Montana?
Yes. So this is a map showing oil and gas wells. These are data from the Montana Department of Natural Resources, I believe. So these are the locations of currently producing oil and gas wells in Montana. Red and pink are the two colors here. I apologize if they look a little similar. But red are the oil wells. They are especially over on the eastern side of the state in what's called the Williston Geologic Basin. The gas wells tend to be, I mean, there's some number of wells in many different parts of the state, but the gas wells tend to be in the north, and this is mainly a function of geology. Although I should note that, you know, many wells produce some amount of oil and gas. It's in many cases all down there together. And what comes up, is, you know, sometimes some liquid and some gas, and the ratios can't just depend on the underground geology.
And over the past 15 years or so, has there been a resurgence as a result of fracking?
Yes, especially in the mid-2000s, the fracking boom really led to an increase in oil and gas production in Montana.
And do the oil and gas wells depicted On this slide, do they require permits from the defendants?
Yes.
Now, you just showed us maps of coal, and you showed us this map of extracting oil and gas. All these things are matters that are happening. But have all the coal and has all the oil and gas, has that all been extracted?
Oh, by no means. So you could say that Montana has only quite literally scratched the surface of the fossil fuels that are remain and are still underground within the state. So geologists and fossil fuel companies tend to talk about what's called reserves. Reserves are quantities of fossil fuels that are known to be in the ground and are believed to be extractable using current technology and at economic conditions. So basically, the companies and the geologic surveys believe that this stuff is extractable, given what they already know today. They surely are aware of much larger deposits of fossil fuels that maybe they just haven't completely yet proven or completely done all the necessary geology to understand whether it's extractable. So this alone is a conservative view of what still remains underground in Montana, but you can see that 707 million short tons or U.S. tons of coal are in reserves in the coal mines in Montana. Walked down the street to the Montana Coal Council the other day, and they had a similar figure and said it was the largest coal reserves in the U.S. or in Montana. So I believe that's using the same data as this.
And while you're talking about coal mines, there's a little figure underneath the square. Can you explain the figure underneath the square?
Yes, that's just a little chart showing how much of the extraction in 2019 is sent out of state.
And just sticking with coal for a moment, in preparing the chart, what did you attempt to do with the proportionality of the squares?
I mean, the size of that red square that is representing 34 million short tons is proportional to the bigger size of the reserves. So it's not just a random size. It's actually the size of those reserves relative to the size of those of the annual production is actually accurate in a proportional way.
You've covered coal. Let's talk. Can you describe what's depicted in the chart for the 4,000 oil wells?
Yeah. So the 23 million barrels of oil that are produced in 2019 came from about 4,000 oil wells in the state. And, you know, there's at least 10 times more oil in the ground currently than is extracted in any given year. So there's at least a 10-year runway, but, you know, activities to find and make more oil extractable are occurring all the time.
And again, the exported figure, what's that for oil wells?
95%.
So 95% is exported?
Yes.
And then the right-hand side or the final group is 5,000 gas wells. Can you explain that?
Yes, similarly to oil, the reserves, the known reserves of gas are many times, 10 to 15 times higher than annual production in Montana. And in terms of export, couldn't find the actual numbers on that, but according to Montana Energy and Focus, I forget, it's a Montana state document, or it's a document that included Montana state researchers. They estimated it was a significant portion.
So in terms of the future actions of the defendants in this case, the CO2 emissions for the fossil fuels yet to be extracted, do they matter?
Absolutely. I mean, we're at this point where all of these decisions are Not only were they relevant in the past, but they're very relevant for the future, right? These fossil fuels that are in the ground represent future sources of emissions, and emissions that can, you know, scarcely be afforded to be burned if we're going to stay within climate limits.
So going back to your three categories, we've talked about extraction, we've talked about consumption. Can you tell us a little bit more about fossil fuel transportation and processing?
Yes. So this is a map, again, from the State of Montana document that shows the oil pipelines and refineries. So as I said earlier, the pipelines that enter in the north from Canada in places like Glacier and Toole counties bring oil south across the state to refineries, a refinery in Great Falls, three refineries in the Billings area. Sometimes they deliver oil to those refineries that is then refined into products like gasoline and diesel. Those are then moved in pipelines to other places in the state where they can be delivered to consumers. But much of the oil just continues on south to Wyoming, either as raw crude oil or as these refined products.
And did all these pipelines receive permits from the state?
Yes.
And do all four refineries in Montana have permits to operate in Montana?
Yes.
And have you reviewed any of these permits?
Yes.
Are there ways other than pipelines that fossil fuels are transported through the state?
Yes, and the data on that is somewhat harder to come by, but fossil fuels are transported through the state on rail cars, coal and crude oil, for example. So the thoroughfare of fossil fuels is not just pipelines, but also rail cars.
So, Mr. Erickson, we've covered a lot of ground so far. Is it appropriate at this point to kind of sum up where we are?
Sure.
Before we move on, can you, in essence, sum up the points you've made just in real quick bullet point fashion?
Can't promise that this will be the end of the numbers, but it's getting close. So I looked at CO2 emissions associated with three different lenses or three different stages of Montana's fossil fuel economy. We had extraction, we had transportation and refining, or what I was calling the thoroughfare, and we have consumption. So extraction was 70 million tons, transport and refining was 80 million tons, consumption was 32 million tons, all in 2019. You add those up all together, count for overlaps, the total is 166 million tons carbon dioxide.
And in your opinion, these numbers are significant in each of the categories as well as the total in terms of quantities of emissions. Is that correct?
Yes.
And why are they significant?
They're significant because, I mean, even the 32, as we saw, that figure is greater than half the countries of the world's own emissions. Countries of the world have banded together and agreed that everybody is responsible for reducing emissions, that everyone has a responsibility. So if Montana is as big as over 100 countries, even by the most narrow definition of its emissions, I can't make any other conclusion but that Montana's emissions are significant.
And what about, again, in summary, taking that, what you just stated, what about going forward? What is the import of the reserves that Montana has in terms of fossil fuel activities?
Right. And I'm not aware of any, you know, great data or forecasts on what is likely to happen in the future in Montana, but the permitting activity continues. And when you look at forecast of energy use from, say, again, that EIA, that federal agency that I've been referring to, they say that fossil fuel use is going to be significant in the Mountain West. Not, they don't have forecasts for Montana, but in the Mountain West for the foreseeable future.
We've heard testimony earlier in this trial from the IPCC's sixth assessment report. And one of the quotes we've heard is every ton of CO2 emissions adds to global warming. Are you familiar with that quote? And can you explain to us how it applies to your testimony today?
Of course. This is a statement made in the sixth assessment report, working group one. Working group one is the working group that looks at the science of climate change. So they are the world's, you know, foremost authorities on this question. And they say every ton, by the way, T-O-N-N-E, that's just a metric ton. Don't get thrown off by that spelling. Every ton of CO2 emissions adds to global warming. So, I mean, if we could go back to the equation I had, right? It was a simple equation. It was fossil fuels. It was how much carbon is in those fossil fuels. How much of that is actually released to the atmosphere? And you get CO2. What this statement means from the IPCC is that each one of those tons of CO2 quite literally adds to global warming.
And so in your opinion, is the state of Montana at a decision point about what it does going forward concerning fossil fuel emissions?
It seems like it. We're at a point where we rapidly need to reduce emissions globally, where the global community has said everybody needs to be on board, and there's no time to waste.
Do you have any opinions as to whether the defendants are continuing to authorize fossil fuel activities?
My only opinion there derives from looking at the, you know, recent permit filings on the DEQ website, and it seems like they continue.
And in your binder's a copy of the document that's been marked as Exhibit P150, and it's the ONEOK Rockies Midstream LLC Western Compressor Station Final Air Quality Permit Number 527401. Is, in terms of recent activities, is this the permit you're referring to?
Yes, this is one of them, yes.
And I move Exhibit 150, P150, into evidence.
No objection.
E150 is admitted.
And can you briefly describe what this permit authorizes?
Sure. This permit is for a natural gas compressor station associated with a gas pipeline.
And was the permit issued on March 31, 2023?
Yes.
And we've earlier talked about statutes, the state energy policy or the amendment to MEPA. Whatever happened there, do those matters affect any of the opinions you've offered here today?
Objection. Foundation.
Well, I guess you can ask it a little bit differently. I mean, does the change in the law make any difference to your numbers as far as what you, I guess this was 2019 anyway.
Well, I suppose you could, I mean, I'm also making statements about what is likely to continue to occur, but no, it doesn't make any material difference to my numbers or to my conclusions because of the conduct, you know, was not only in the past, but also appears to be continuing.
Your Honor, Mr. Erickson provided a rebuttal report to Drs. Curry and Anderson, as he earlier indicated. However, he will not be able to come back because he'll be in a surgical gown. So as with the prior witnesses, I'd request the ability for him to offer testimony that is, in essence, rebuttal testimony. And should either of those witnesses not cover the topics that he's testifying about today, we would agree, as I'm sure the defendants would, to strike that testimony.
So stipulated.
All right. Thank you.
So, Mr. Erickson, you wrote a rebuttal report in response to the reports of Drs. Curry and Anderson. Is that correct?
I did.
And, and obviously you reviewed those reports before you, prepared your rebuttal report.
Yes.
And, so let's start with one of the issues addressed by Drs. Curry and Anderson. And I'm sorry, should I just identify for the record? And I forgot to do this earlier, Your Honor. So Exhibit P-170, again, just for the record, is Mr. Erickson's rebuttal report. And Exhibit, I'm sorry, Your Honor, is, I'm looking for the, I'll get the number of Mr. Oh, it's P-163 is Mr. Erickson's original report. So, Mr. Erickson, let's start with one of the issues addressed by both Drs. Curry and Anderson. Is it correct that Dr. Curry does not dispute your figure of 32 million metric tons of energy-related CO2 that Montana emitted?
No, neither Dr. Curry nor Dr. Anderson dispute that, and one of them has virtually identical calculation of their own.
Okay. And yet, Dr. Curry claims that this 32 million metric tons is, quote, minuscule, close quote, or not meaningful, close quote. And do you remember that part of her report? And do you remember that Dr. Anderson agrees with Dr. Curry on that minuscule, not significant point?
I think they make similar statements. I'm not sure they refer to each other, but yes.
Okay. And do you agree with the characterization of these 32 million metric tons of energy-related carbon dioxide emissions as being, quote, minuscule or, quote, not meaningful?
I do not agree with that.
And can you explain why you don't?
Yes. I mean, to call that quantity of emissions minuscule is also to call the emissions of over 100 individual countries minuscule. I mean, that's just, if she's calling 32 minuscule, that's just the fact of the math. So it's troubling because the countries of the world have agreed in negotiations that everybody has responsibility to reduce emissions. The major scientific body of the world, IPCC, says, as shown here, that every ton of CO2 emissions adds to global warming. So for them to make their own judgments, it seems about that being minuscule seems to me to be misleading and really to misrepresent the nature of both the science and international cooperation on climate change.
Going on to another point from Dr. Anderson. Dr. Anderson asserts that it's, quote, implausible that Montana's policies are causing harm to the climate. Do you agree?
Again, I can't agree because of the simple math of fossil fuels leading to CO2, CO2 leading to warming, and warming leading to damages. Every ton of CO2 emitted in the world is equivalent to any other. So Montana's emissions matter.
And that's basic physics, right?
Yes.
In your view, is the Curry and Anderson comparison that they do in their respective reports of Montana's emissions to global emissions in line with the position of the federal government?
Well, no, it's misleading, but it's also, it goes against the Council on Environmental Quality guidance. And this is final guidance from 2016, by the way. I think these are people that have really thought about this question. And if I may, I'd like to read what they say, because I've almost never found a better statement.
I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, okay.
Before I read it, I just should just say that this was from 2016, but there is current guidance, interim guidance that has almost this exact same statement. So this is not just in the past, this is current as well. So they say,
before it gets read, I would like to board here just briefly.
I'm sorry, you want to board?
May I board here briefly before this gets read? It's not an exhibit, not been admitted.
Yes.
This is not the current guidance, as you just said. Is that right? This CEQ guidance is not current.
I'm not familiar exactly with what gets considered current. When I filed my report, there was a statement on the Department of Energy website that says, please use this guidance for now. We are in the process of updating our guidance. So when I went yesterday to the website and looked at what the current interim guidance was, it has a almost identical paragraph to this. So I leave it to the lawyers to determine whether that is current guidance, I guess.
But it's a new document on this topic has replaced the one that we're looking at here.
Your Honor, I don't mean to interrupt counsel. We're happy at the break to substitute the current, or what Mr. Erickson is describing as the interim guidance, with the guidance that he used at the time his expert report was written. Okay. Counsel would like us to use the...
If that's... We'll look at it then, Your Honor. I mean, I object to this not being the current guidance. If they produce the current guidance, and I have no objection.
So do you want to take your afternoon recess?
Sure, we can, certainly, Your Honor, we can do that and hopefully substitute it, and I think we can do it fairly quickly.
You're saying it's pretty much identical.
If I may just comment, I'm not one of the attorneys. I'm not representing this as some sort of legal standard. I'm representing this as really clear language about what it means to compare emissions to global totals. And the language is virtually identical. I don't care which one I say. So you all, Your Honor, you can decide that.
I agree. And I think the plaintiffs want to offer this as an exhibit. And so they're kind of agreeing to getting the most up to date done before then is what I'm kind of getting out of this. So I think we'll go ahead and take our recess. We'll be in recess for about 15 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Recording stopped.
And then, Your Honor, what we've substituted in the Federal Register interim guidelines, as we discussed just before the break, and plaintiffs will make a copy of that, provide it to the court and to counsel for defendants, labeling it as Exhibit 311, and I'd request that that be admitted.
No objection.
311 is admitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Erickson, we've now got the interim guidance that we spoke about before we broke and displayed on the screen, correct?
Yes.
And then there was language that you wanted to read into the record from that guidance. And it said on that particular page of Monday, January 9, 2023, at page 1201. Could you read that language, please?
Yes. And first, let me just put it in context again so we have some continuity. This is language about how federal agencies analyze greenhouse gas emissions associated with projects or actions or activities, with big things. And it's in regard to the kinds of comparisons we were talking about before the break, meaning comparisons of individual sources of emissions to global totals. Okay. So that's what's meant by comparisons and fractions here. Okay. So if I may, this is the quote. Moreover, such comparisons and fractions also are not an appropriate method for characterizing the extent of a proposed action and its alternatives, contributions to climate change, because this approach does not reveal anything beyond the nature of the climate challenge itself. The fact that diverse individual sources of emissions each make a relatively small addition to global atmospheric GHG concentrations that collectively have a large effect. So, I mean, this is one of the clearest statements of that I've ever seen. If I put it in my own words, it's, you know, you can't say that an individual source isn't important just because the problem is so big, right? That's saying to do that is to say more about the size of the problem than it is to say anything meaningful about your own action. And I think that's, you know, very relevant here because of, in response to the testimony of Dr. Curry and Anderson.
In her expert report, Dr. Curry states that because of the scale of Montana's emissions, the state, quote, is powerless on its own to influence the global or its local climate, close quote. Similarly, Dr. Anderson asserts that Montana's policies, quote, have virtually no effect on global climate change, close quote. Do you have an opinion concerning these statements?
I do, and so I'm sort of going to put powerless and virtually no effect in the same one bucket. And then there's an extra part of Curry's statement that said on its own that I want to address. So first, the idea that Montana is powerless or would have virtually no effect. The effect, I think, is clear from the math of the emissions and the fact that every ton of emissions adds to global warming and that every increment of global warming leads to increased damages. So I think that is an established fact that contradicts to me what seems like the very strident claim of powerless. I think, you know, there's can be discussion about exactly what those powers are, but that's not what I'm, you know, prepared to go into much detail about today. In regards to the on its own bit, I recognize that the plaintiffs here are asking, you know, they're bringing this case here to Montana, right? For a very good reason. But the idea that Montana would be acting on its own also doesn't really stand up to me because there is this global effort among nations. There is an effort among U.S. states to work together, share policies to amplify the effects of their work to reduce emissions. There's something, for example, called the Powering Past Coal Alliance that both U.S. states and countries are members of, and that they work together to figure out how to phase out coal. So there's no on its own here, in my view.
And you also had testified earlier about the extent of the reserves. Will that have an effect in terms of where Dr. Anderson asserts that Montana's policies, quote, have virtually no effect on global climate change, close quote?
Well, yes. I mean, if Montana has the largest coal reserves in the U.S. and is issuing permits to, as we heard from Ms. Hedges, to expand those mines, it seems like a rather direct conclusion to make that decisions made in Montana affect combustion of coal on a very large scale. And that's not minuscule. That's not powerless.
In your opinion, could Montana leverage its efforts to address the climate crisis?
Yes. And leverage here, I'm going to interpret as gaining more benefit beyond the state than would just occur within the state. And again, that comes in large part because of this cooperative effort that's already underway. You know, other states like Washington, Oregon, nearby states would be, you know, more than happy to work with Montana to achieve more together than they would on their own.
In their expert reports, did Drs. Curry or Anderson dispute your calculation where you arrived at the 166 figure for Montana's fossil fuel energy system?
No, I don't recall that they even addressed that.
Instead, for in terms of your calculations, what did you understand they focused on?
They focused on the in-state consumption of fossil fuels. What I had is 32, and I believe, again, one of them had is 32 as well.
And another issue addressed by Dr. Curry is the geopolitical risks of reducing fossil fuel production. In your opinion, in terms of fossil fuel consumption globally, what effect has, say, Russia's war on Ukraine had on the transition away from fossil fuels?
I think it a couple of things. It probably too early to say, but probably helped accelerate it. But even more importantly, it's shown how beholden the fossil fuel markets are to the actions of individual and sometimes rogue actors. So if we have fossil fuel markets that can go from $60 a barrel to $100 a barrel, for example, very quickly due to disruptions, perhaps purposeful disruptions in those supplies, that is a world in which lots of regular people need to spend more, a lot more on oil and gas, for example. I mean, on gasoline here. So there are energy security, there are geopolitical benefits to getting away from fossil fuels that the Ukraine war has helped us show. And it's not just me saying this, right? Like, there's International Energy Agency reports that come to similar conclusions.
In his report, Dr. Anderson makes an assertion that the extent to which Montana's policies are, quote, causing or contributing to global warming, close quote, quote, must be offset by policies that have reduced Montana's emissions and reduced global climate change. Do you have an opinion as to whether Montana can offset any reduction in greenhouse gas emissions against its ongoing contribution to climate change?
So first, let me just say, if Montana is making efforts to increase renewable energy, that's great. Like, there's no, that they should be rewarded or, you know, praised in some way for that. However, this statement, I need to take Mr. Anderson's use of the word offset on face value here, because offset means something in climate and greenhouse gas accounting, which is my area of expertise, right? An offset is something that you buy or commission in a marketplace to credit against your own emissions. There are ways of doing that legitimately. What he's describing is absolutely not one of them, right? He's saying that, again, if taking the words literally, that Montana should get to credit reductions relative to some imagined emissions that it didn't emit against its own actual emissions. Now, I'm sorry, but I have to try to use a metaphor here because it's so preposterous. I like cake, but a lot of people here like cake. Imagine I have a piece of cake and I eat that piece of cake. It's delicious. And imagine I really want another piece of cake. There's another piece of cake sitting in the kitchen. I don't eat that piece of cake. What was my cake consumption today? Zero. One piece of cake plus a negative one piece of cake. Zero cake. That's great. So that is, you know, you can't offset your own emissions against something you didn't do. If you didn't do that thing, that's enough credit in its own, because that should have reduced your actual emissions or take.
Now, how is this offsetting argument, as you understand it, addressed by greenhouse gas emissions accounting rules?
Well, no greenhouse gas accounting rules, including ones I've helped write, would allow one to offset one's own emissions against one's imagined emissions that didn't occur.
Dr. Anderson also claims that Montana's greenhouse gas emissions declined between 2019 and 2022. Do you have an opinion on this claim as it relates to the use of your data? In other words, why'd you use 2019?
Okay, I understand. I used 2019 because that was the most recent year for which the Department of Energy had published comprehensive statistics that covered all the areas I wanted to cover. In fact, they didn't really have anything even for 2020 at that time. It takes them a while sometimes. But he's making a point that has some truth to it. Emissions, in my understanding, in Montana, again, associated with fossil fuels consumed in Montana, did decline between 2019 and 2020. They did perhaps decline some to today, although I don't think we have the data yet. There was also a global pandemic in the years that he's referencing, 2020, 2021, and 2022. A major cause of the drop in emissions between 2019 and 2020 was this reduction in energy use and, unfortunately, economic activity in Montana during that year. There were also other reasons. Colstrip 1 and 2 closed in early January, I think it was, of 2020. So that's a reason. That's a good reason. So maybe Montana's emissions have decreased a little bit in a way that we could believe is durable, but it's too early to tell is what I would say. Like, there are sources of emissions that are increasing, as I showed earlier, gas, natural gas and gasoline and diesel. There are some that, at least preliminarily, may be decreasing, like coal. So how that's going to balance out in the next few years is in large part a matter of policy about this Montana's energy system.
Were there other issues you had with the presentation by Dr. Anderson of numbers? And here I'm talking about the numbers used in his appendix table 1.
Yes. So in that appendix, he makes claims about this question I just raised about the future of Montana's emissions. He makes claims that Montana's future emissions are going to decline. Those claims are based not on Montana forecasts, unfortunately. They're based on forecasts for the Mountain West region. I mean, I went up and looked up his numbers and found where they were in the EIA's annual energy outlook, and the plain numbers were sitting there for the Mountain West, which includes 8 states, including states with bigger economies than Montana, like Colorado. So it doesn't mean it's wrong. I mean, I can't, but it seems to me to be misleading to represent this forecast of a much larger 8-state region as Montana, because it might be different, right? The individual energy mixes of each state are dependent on what residents and businesses in those states do and what the governments in those states do. So I just wanted to point that out for purposes of accuracy.
So, Mr. Erickson, can you please summarize your rebuttal to Drs. Curry and Anderson?
I can. There might be a previous slide on this, too. Yes, thank you. So, first, Drs. Curry and Anderson only look at fossil fuel emissions from consumption, from combustion inside Montana, and don't look at these other ways that Montana supports the fossil fuel economy and leads to CO2 emissions. They misrepresent the importance of Montana's substantial carbon dioxide emissions and greenhouse gas emissions and the cooperative nature of the global effort to limit global warming. They characterize Montana's greenhouse gas emissions as small. I guess that's their choice. But I think, you know, as we looked at the Council for Environmental Quality guidance, that in their words is a inappropriate approach. So in my view, they really fail here. By they, I mean Drs. Currie and Anderson, fail to acknowledge how Montana's emissions in absolute are similar, greater than many other countries. Many's an understatement here. It's over 100. And they misrepresent or mischaracterize the notion that every government on the planet needs to reduce emissions dramatically to stop worsening climate change. So they also, you know, don't incorporate, you could say ignore the scientific statement of the IPCC that every ton of CO2 emissions adds to global warming and therefore increases the frequency and severity of climate impacts. They don't recognize that Montana's contribution to global greenhouse gas emissions is nationally and globally significant. And they, I mean, I would say that Montana's responsibility and ability to transition away from fossil fuels is actually substantial.
In March of this year, the IPCC released, as you know, the summary for policymakers that we've marked as Exhibit P143. Do the findings of this report provide support for your conclusions?
Yes.
Can you give me some examples?
Yes. And the reason I bring these up is, as a scientist, as one who works on climate change, I am always going to be looking at the new IPCC reports. IPCC scientists are traditionally, you might say, notoriously conservative in what they're willing to agree to say in these summary for policymakers and synthesis documents. So, you know, statements like every ton matters are not made lightly by the IPCC. So here's another one, again, just from this year that I thought was significant. Continued emissions will further affect all major climate system components, with every additional increment of global warming, changes in extremes continue to become larger. Every additional increment. And I think just one other, because this one is perhaps gets closest to speaking to Montana and us in the room here. Government actions at subnational, as an aside, subnational is a bit of a term of art, which means governments like states in the U.S., right? Not national, subnational. Governments at actions at subnational, national, and international levels with civil society and the private sector play a crucial role in enabling and accelerating shifts in development pathways towards sustainability and climate resilient development. That is a comment that they make with what they call very high confidence. So in my words, what happens in Montana matters.
So, Mr. Erickson, can you provide us with a conclusion concerning your opinions here today?
Sure. I think what I've tried to demonstrate today, and I think I have, is that what happens in Montana matters in terms of fossil fuel energy systems and carbon dioxide emissions, and therefore global warming. And because of the nature of Montana's emissions and the global effort to minimize climate damages, to ameliorate climate damages, that Montana has the responsibility and the opportunity, there is an opportunity side to this too that we can talk about, to steer its energy system away from high carbon fossil fuels and towards other low and zero carbon activities to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that are contributing to climate change.
Thank you, sir. Your Honor, may I take a moment to move in some of the exhibits that I alluded to earlier? And one of them is, Mr. Erickson's attachment to his expert report, Exhibit P214. And as reflected, I said earlier, the exhibits that are set forth on attachment two are exhibits P264, all the way to P301. and they're reflected in the exhibit list. I hope I don't have to go through each of those a number, but my understanding is based on the meet and confer efforts of the parties, we've been able to resolve that those permits come in, except for what I'm going to generally call a relevancy objection, and I'd like to move those in now.
And we do object, Your Honor, on the grounds of relevance. And with respect to the oldest ones in here, 1974 and 1976, foundation and authenticity.
So,
Your Honor, I had understood that we'd resolve those in terms of foundation and authenticity. So,
okay, I withdraw that, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Okay, but you still object on relevance.
On relevance.
All right, I will admit P214 and P264 to 301.
Thank you, Your Honor. And then I know the court's dealing with this issue just after Mr. Erickson, so I would move in subject to the court's decision, his expert report P163 and his rebuttal report P170.
And for the record, the same objection as the other ones.
Yeah. I'm not going to admit those reports. So P170 and P163 are refused.
Your Honor, I'm finished with my examination.
All right.
Mr. Erickson.
Ross.
Good afternoon, sir.
Hello, Mr. Sturmitz.
How are you today?
Good, thank you.
You seem like a guy that always would say that, no matter what, even if you're facing surgery. let me start where we finished up about the role of Montana in all of this. You know, of course, this is a court of law in the state of Montana, right?
Yes, sir.
And so you would agree that whatever happens here is through the judge and the authority given the judge by the laws of Montana. True?
I believe so, yes.
Well, I mean, it seems like an obvious question.
It does, yeah.
But we've been talking a lot about the legislature and the governor and people and everything else here, but the court is the ultimate decision maker for what we're talking about today. You understand that?
Yes.
And with that in mind, if you can, what specifically is your understanding about what we're litigating today? What are we here to decide?
I understand that mainly through the complaint of the plaintiffs, which, as I understand it, had two components and maybe has been narrowed to one. Those were that, Montana State's constitution, in its providing for environmental protections should also protect for the climate. So that was one, request. I'm not sure the legal term. The other being that there should be some remedy applied. My limited understanding is that the remedy is no longer being discussed, but I'm not actually sure.
Okay. We'll need to clear that up a little bit. One thing I'll represent to you that we're not litigating is Montana's Energy Policy Act, because that's been removed from the lawsuit. But we are litigating a provision of the Montana Environmental Policy Act that was enacted by the legislature in May of this year. Are you aware of that?
Is this what Ms. Hedges was referring to earlier this morning about the...
Yes.
The NEPA and evaluating greenhouse gas emissions associated with projects. Okay.
Yes. And so with that in mind, that it's the NEPA provision that's at issue here, the question to you is, when you talk about permitting, are you aware, do you have any appreciation for the role of NEPA in that process in Montana?
Only what I learned this morning from Ms. Hedges.
Okay. And how would you describe your understanding of what that was that she said? If you could summarize.
Do you mean the current state, the previous state, or what's being decided? Yes,
as we sit here today, what is the role of the statute that was passed by the Montana legislature a month or so ago in permitting projects in Montana?
First off, it's hearsay because the witness said, all I know is what Ms. Hedges said. So I'm just going to further, Your Honor, it's also called for speculation because there's no evidence that there's been any foundation laid. He knows anything about the MEPA provision except from the testimony of Ms. Hedges.
He did not testify as an expert on MEPA, so I'm going to sustain an objection to this line of questioning.
So, for the record, Your Honor, can we represent that when Mr. Erickson talks about permitting and the plaintiffs introduce a permit in evidence that MEPA is not the statute that accomplishes this? Because that's my fear. There's a misleading angle here, which is to conflate MEPA's role with the permits that are actually issued for air quality and water quality and that sort of thing. That's what I'm getting at.
I'm not clear, Your Honor, when he talks about MEPA. The permit that we introduced in evidence was from March of 2023, and I was understanding that the question that was being asked applied to the current version of the statute, MEPA, and I'm unclear how a March 2023 permit relates to a statute recently enacted.
Mr.
Wait a minute, then you're kind of getting into, you're saying it's not relevant. I just don't think that you need to be asking him legal questions.
I understand that, Your Honor.
Okay.
He gave legal answers, however, for the record, including the fact that the new statute doesn't change anything that he has to say. And that's on the record. So I'm trying to address that. And if the court disagrees, then I live by that. That's the way it goes. One thing that, with all the, statistics that we've heard today that we didn't hear is the total greenhouse gas emissions globally. And I'm going to, first of all, is that correct? You haven't testified about that, have you? I might have missed it, but
I don't believe I mentioned that total. Yeah.
And is the reason that you didn't mention the total amount of greenhouse gas emissions globally because, you would not agree that there should be any comparison for Montana's contribution to that figure? If that's not the reason, please tell us the reason.
The reason I didn't mention the global total of greenhouse gas emissions was mainly simply because I was trying to find other sources of greenhouse gas emissions, or rather other jurisdictions that emit greenhouse gas emissions that are more directly comparable, I guess, to Montana's, in the sense that because I was mainly talking about Montana's absolute greenhouse gas emissions, and to make that relevant to a layperson, to me, it seemed to be important to make comparisons to other jurisdictions that were similar.
Well, wouldn't we want to know if a decision has to be made on whether you could measure Montana's impact on the global scale? Wouldn't we want to know what the global figure is?
I have no objection to discussing the global figure, if that's what you're suggesting. Yeah.
Asking why we haven't heard about it. So do you know off the top of your head what that figure is? Hopefully, and we won't take this as gospel, 40 billion tons per year globally. And do you know what, just off the top of your head, and you may not, what the greatest amount of greenhouse gas emissions from any one country is, which country is the leader in the world, so to speak, for greenhouse gas emissions?
It's China.
And what do they contribute, you know, roughly?
Off the top of my head, I'd say it's 9 or 10.
Nine or 10 what's it?
Billion tons.
Okay. And next, you know how they rank? Or if I gave you the list, would you tell me whether you agree or disagree?
Sorry, which country or the whole list?
I'll just go through the top. The U.S., I believe U.S. is number 3. China and India are ahead of us. Does that sound right?
That doesn't sound right to me, sir.
What would you say?
China, U.S., and then India.
Okay. And where do we go from there? You know,
Russia, Japan, Brazil. There might be somebody above Brazil. Sir, I don't keep a full list in my head.
Good enough. And you discussed, skipping around a little here, but you discussed per capita greenhouse gas emissions. And what country, if you know, ranks number 1 there?
I'm not sure.
All right. If I represented it was Qatar, would you disagree?
I don't have any information in the top of my head to evaluate that one way or another, but I also, that means I don't have any information to disagree.
Again, on a per capita basis, in that upper segment of that list, I'll represent, and I stand subject to correction if I'm wrong, Qatar, Trinidad and Tobago, and Netherlands, Antilles being the top 3. Oh, and then from there, kind of similar sorts of countries. If that's the case, why is it that we see countries like that, island countries, small countries, ranking at the top of the list for per capita greenhouse gas emissions? Can you explain that to us, please?
I'm not sure I understand the question about why.
Well,
is it a question about math or about their
question? It's just a math question. How is it that a country the size of Qatar is the number 1 per capita emitter of greenhouse gases in the world?
Qatar is a major oil producer, so it has, you know, flaring and other activities that are contributing to emissions for the oil it produces for the whole world and relative to its population, to get to your math point.
Right. So on the math of per capita, you've got 2 factors, the output of greenhouse gases and the population. That drives that is how you define the per capita figure, correct?
That's right.
So when you compare Montana to other countries, first of all, you testified that you picked countries that had a similar total emission output as Montana, right?
Yes.
So you didn't, at least we didn't hear, maybe you can explain now, factor in the other mathematical driver, which is population, as compared to those emissions, did you?
I feel like I alluded to it. I mean, I had figures for emissions and population, but I think you're correct. I mean, I didn't literally report the emissions per person for other countries.
The point you were making primarily, if I understand right, was that Ireland, for example, has a figure close to what Montana does for greenhouse gas emissions. And that was the primary point.
Yes.
Okay. Now, so I'm going to assume from this questioning that we've had that you haven't done the math on what percentage Montana's total greenhouse gas emissions represent on a global scale. Is that right?
I haven't. I mean, we just laid out the numbers that one could do that, but no, I haven't.
And go ahead and explain why not, or why you wouldn't find that to be useful, if you would, please.
I think I covered this in my testimony, but it's basically that when you're making a comparison to the global total, that says more about the global total simply because it's so large, than it does to the contributions of any individual actor. And because climate change results from cumulative raw absolute carbon dioxide emissions, that really at the end of the day is what's most important.
And I'm assuming that what you testified to toward the end there about from the CEQ guidance is part of the reason why as well, isn't it? That the comparison would not be useful for accounting for greenhouse gases from your perspective. Because it's, even though small, Montana's, you add them all up and it adds up to 40 billion tons per year.
I'm not sure I understand the question about its usefulness. Is that the question?
Well, let me put it this way. If it is useful to know, for example, to a court having to decide whether it can order some relief that will address the plaintiff's problems, if it is useful to know what Montana's contribution percentage mathematically is to the total greenhouse gas loading of the world, we should probably figure that out, right?
I'm not sure that logically follows.
Okay. Explain to me why not.
Montana's emissions are going to contribute to climate change irrespective of what other countries do. Like every ton of CO2 matters, that means, and matters equally, that means that it doesn't really matter, sorry to use that word again, but to the atmosphere, whether Montana's emissions are bigger or smaller than someone else's, they matter on their own. I mean, there are some, well, I'll leave it there.
Yeah, and we've heard other witnesses, plaintiff's witnesses, say that very thing. Every ton matters. And by the same logic, every ounce matters. Would you agree with that? There's no distinction there, right?
In terms of the literal math of it, yes.
And so what I'm getting at is when we say, when you say, and the other experts say it matters, what does it matter to in relation to this court's authority to do something that can be measured in Montana?
The question calls for a legal conclusion.
I'm asking about the science of this, Your Honor.
Yeah, but you're asking what the court, I mean, how that impacts the court's decision, I guess.
Well, let me rephrase that.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. If every ounce matters, how do you measure the impact in Montana of the reduction of 1 ounce, which is a ridiculous, you know, amount, I admit, for purposes of this hypothetical, 1 ounce of CO2. That, could you do that?
Is your question about the literal scientific ability to measure using equipment the change in warming in Montana?
Absolutely it is.
There are limits to scientific equipment, sir. I don't know exactly what those...
Do you know whether 1 ton, the impact in Montana of the removal of 1 ton of greenhouse gas emissions would have on a practical, factual basis?
I don't, but that is straightforward math to do.
Well, and the math you're talking about would be you could just do a percentage and you'd end up with, right, it would be the Montana's 1 ton in the numerator and 40 billion tons as a denominator.
Not exactly. The math would be the terms of the equation I had. I mean, CO2 times how much warming results from each ton of CO2. And that would be some number.
Right. I get that. But if you built in to that equation the warming factor, both on the 1 ton side and the 40 billion ton side, that's a wash, and you come up with a percentage, wouldn't you?
You'd come up with a percentage, yes.
And that percentage, it's a number. It's just a factual number, right?
Yes.
And I think from what you just said, that percentage, whatever it was, if it could be measured, and again, I'm talking about one ton over 40 billion tons here. This is my hypothetical. You wouldn't be able to say how we would see an effect here in Montana from that reduction. Is that true?
I need to make a distinction here between what warming would result and the ability to measure that warming.
Okay.
Are you asking me to explain?
No, yeah, sure. Go ahead. Sorry.
The ability to measure the warming is subject to all kinds of factors that are varying every day. I mean, every year, I doubt that it would be difficult to measure using scientific equipment how much any given actor changed warming. And that is why, scientists rely on, more simple equations to estimate the effect on warming of a given unit of carbon dioxide.
That's the 40, you had an equation up in your first slide that measured that, right?
Not exactly.
Okay, that's fine. So if and this maybe is not a question within your area of expertise, but if you can't just say one ton equals X or one ton matters necessarily, I mean, does it matter necessarily if there are these factors that go into telling us what the impact of removing one ton would be?
My expertise is in greenhouse gas accounting. Others have expertise in the real details of atmospheric physics. It is absolutely possible to say that one ton of CO2 leads to this many watts per meter squared change in radiative forcing and therefore warming, for example. We could call in experts like that. I am not prepared to tell you the exact amount of warming that results from any given tons of CO2.
Okay, that's fair. In the realm of greenhouse gas accounting, you have assigned in Montana's tally an amount for fossil fuels that come into Montana at one end and leave at the other. And in between, we don't do anything other than have maybe the railroad tracks or the pipeline that transports it. That's correct, is it not?
Yes.
And is that how typically your industry, I'm looking for the right word, your profession does that?
What do you mean by typically?
Well, I mean, is there a convention or a rule or a law or something that says when you're accounting for greenhouse gas emissions attributable to a state, you must include fossil fuels that go through the state without the state either generating them or combusting them?
I don't think there's any law. There's no absolutes about that, sir, but it is common practice, for example, in evaluating the greenhouse gas emissions of a pipeline to include all of the CO2 that results from the fuel carried by the pipeline. So that, regardless of where it starts and ends, so that is an analogous situation to what you're asking about.
And when you say results from, you're talking about this material ending up somewhere and actually getting into the atmosphere by being combusted, right?
Yes.
So let's just take one of the pipelines that transports gas through Montana. Do you know where most of that ends up on any of these pipelines in Montana? Where do they go? Who gets that material?
Well, the oil pipeline that comes from Canada, most of that goes on to Wyoming and refineries, and you know, the end consumers are all over.
Okay, let's just use that for an example. If someone was going to do a calculation of greenhouse gas emissions in Wyoming, would they subtract the fossil fuel that's coming into the state through Montana because it's already been accounted for in Montana's total?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Are you referring to another, a different state other than Montana?
A different state or a different nation. Let's talk about coal. Montana's coal ends up, I don't know, let's say India or China or somewhere. And in your calculations, Montana has been made responsible for that because it's going through our state. But you can't count it twice. I mean, right? You either count it when it's being transported or you count it when it gets combusted.
It's not that simple.
Okay, explain why.
There are different lenses that one can apply to emissions. There's no globally correct lens to assign responsibility on emissions because that is, frankly, a judgment in terms of whose responsibility it is. So what I've tried to do to be both comprehensive and transparent to allow us to have this kind of conversation is to separate out the emissions in each category very transparently into these different lenses. So if you were to ask me under a particular lens, like the consumption-based lens, where does that coal get assigned, you know, like an accountant, which column does it go in? I could answer and be straightforward about that.
Okay, and so we'll do that. You have assigned in the transportation column fossil fuels that are transported through Montana, but neither extracted here nor combusted here.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
And that's your judgment in how you've decided to approach in a transparent way your calculations here today, right?
Right, for that category, yes.
Yes. So let's say we have a pipeline coming into Montana that terminates in Montana. And I don't know. I'm just saying hypothetically. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. Terminates and is combusted here. You would calculate that just on the combustion side, but not on the transportation side, I assume, right?
That's right. I tried not to include things in the transportation column that stayed within the state.
So do you know whether when we look at your profession, greenhouse gas accounting in particular, and we're looking at global actors and how they what they do with greenhouse gases, whether they know in these figures, whether these the totals have been accounted for in a way that would avoid double counting?
They do. Countries are very clear about the rules they use for accounting in the international negotiations.
Okay. So if there was international negotiations over greenhouse gas emissions that involved China's combustion of Montana coal, would these accounting mechanisms be applied? That is, making sure it gets accounted for in one location, but not two.
Yes, absolutely. There's no double counting permitted in the international accounting framework that countries have agreed to. They all decide on a particular lens to look at things from.
And in your accounting for Montana, the total 166 million tons per year, you've back your figures in. 80 million tons plus per year is in the transportation column, right?
Correct.
I want to make sure I'm clear about one thing here on transportation while we're talking about it. When you, in that column, transportation in your calculations, that's just moving the material. It's actually, let me rephrase that. It's just the fact that the material has been moved through the state. It's not, for example, the
emissions from the train that moved it or the trucks that haul it, right?
That's a good clarifying question, and yes, that's correct.
So I think we need to be careful about transportation, because there's transportation emissions figures, all, you know, we could find them all over, that are just the emissions from diesel fuel used to transport whatever, right? I mean, it wouldn't even matter what they're calling.
That's right.
Okay. And so we could remove, hypothetically, you could remove that 80 million tons per year from the overall equation, and you wouldn't be including any actual emissions that occurred in Montana.
I'd have to go deep into the math to confirm that, but I believe that's correct.
I mean,
conceptually, yeah, that's right.
And just to be clear about this, the category is transported through or refined in Montana.
Right.
So that the refinery would be a combustion in Montana.
Right. The emissions that come out of the refinery stack would be in the consumption column, okay, not in the transport and refining.
Got it. So whatever Montana's percentage is of global greenhouse gas loading, if we hypothetically remove from Montana's column the judgment that you made to include 80 million tons of transportation, we would, whatever our percentage is, it'd be about half after that removal, right? I'm just doing 80 million, being half of 166 million total.
I acknowledge your math there. Yes.
That's about as complicated as I can.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned in your testimony that pipelines, for example, were controlled or permitted by the state of Montana. Do you recall saying that?
Yes. Or that they received permits. Yeah.
Are you aware of any entity, other entity that permits interstate pipelines in Montana that go through Montana?
Yes.
And who would that be?
I can't claim to remember the name of the agency, but there's a federal agency that regulates interstate.
Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Sure.
FERC. And do you know how, if at all, Montana's authority over interstate pipelines interacts or even exists in comparison to FERC's authority?
I'm not sure how to make a comparison.
Well, say we have a pipeline that goes through Montana. Let's even make it more clear by saying it goes not just interstate, but it's international, crosses Montana, the international border. And you'd agree that a federal agency regulates that pipeline, wouldn't you?
I would agree. Yes, I wouldn't necessarily say that it was the only entity that regulated it.
And back to my earlier question, because you can't say it's the only, do you know how the authority would break down between state and federal on a pipeline that went through Montana and crossed the international border?
You're asking me to make a judgment about I'm not sure how to compare. Like, what do you mean? How does it relate?
Well, you testified that you put these pipelines in Montana's column because Montana permitted them, and I'm trying to find out the level of your knowledge about that very thing.
I see.
Okay. And what is the level of your knowledge about that? If you're talking about pipelines that are either interstate or international.
What I can say is that Montana has some permitting authority over pipelines and therefore has some ability to influence how, when, whether that pipeline gets built or is operated. I'm not making any claims about the extent of that authority relative to anyone else. That is not my area of expertise. I think other experts like Ms. Hedges could speak to that better.
Okay. So, but even though you don't know the extent of Montana's authority, you gave Montana 100% of the responsibility for the fossil fuels that go through those pipelines, did you not?
Not exactly.
Okay.
I looked at one lens, that was transportation of fossil fuels through Montana that quantified those emissions. The precise sharing of responsibility for those emissions, I'm not sure I said that right. The precise, yeah, sharing of responsibility of those emissions is not so much in the end, a scientific question. I'm simply doing the math of it.
And assigning Montana 80 million tons per year of fossil fuels in our total is not a scientific decision, right? I mean, you just said that.
It's a scientific calculation. I think
mathematically it is.
Yes, I mean, climate change is a shared responsibility. So exactly who does what at what time is not, you know, for me, in my area of expertise, what I've been asked to testify here today, you know, to say.
Let's talk briefly about coal. You're aware, I assume, that there's of the total coal present or that has been mined in Montana, there's a large percentage of that that's federally owned, right?
I'm not aware of the exact percentage that's federal, but yeah, there are federal lands that mine coal in Washington.
And I'm not going to ask about the exact percentage. What I am going to ask is whether you accounted for in the fossil fuels extracted in Montana, that would be that category, coal that's mined here, right? That's part of your 70 million tons. Whether you accounted for federal coal, federal that's leased by the federal government and not by the state of Montana in any way. Did you figure that into it?
I did not take into account the jurisdiction that issues the lease.
Okay. And are you aware that Montana has, I don't want to use the word several because it's more than that, but quite a few Indian reservations within the state's boundaries.
Yes.
And are you familiar with the tribal role in permitting mines or anything else like this, if any?
Not in any detail.
I think you said towards the end of your testimony, and correct me if this is not an accurate statement, that individual energy mixes in each state are dependent on basically the circumstances of each state. Is that a fair statement of your testimony?
Circumstances broadly construed, yes. I believe I said related to the policies of the state government, to the actions of individuals, to the actions of businesses and industries.
You did. And in making comparisons, per capita consumption consumption of fossil fuels between Montana and elsewhere, did you evaluate whether those entities had similar policies, governmental, all the things you just listed?
No.
Mr. Erickson, following up on what we were just talking about, there was a map you put up, and we could show it if we needed to, of all the oil wells in Montana, the red dots, you would call that. Did you delineate, or do you know which of those are located on either federal lands or tribal lands?
I did not do that delineation.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Redirect.
Mr. Erickson, if in order to view the opinions you've offered here today, what's most important is the ongoing cumulative emissions over which Montana's government has control. Is that correct?
Objection leading.
Well, that's true, but in the interest of, I'll let you ask that question after that. Try not to lead.
Thank you.
Yes, the overriding the most important thing is the emissions that Montana has, you know, some control or direct influence over.
Assuming Montana's coal goes to China, is a permit required for that coal to be extracted in Montana?
Yes. And may I make another point on the accounting question of that?
Sure.
Partly in response to Mr. Sturmitz's line of questioning.
Sure.
So you remember I mentioned a state level, or sorry, a community scale greenhouse gas accounting standard that I contributed to. That standard itself, said, again, this was a stakeholder process. This isn't something that I made up. I just contributed to. That standard, acknowledges that subnational jurisdictions have different authorities, different controls, different types of influence over emissions, and activities in their state. Those emissions themselves may occur outside the state, but if the influence, if the ability to influence those emissions lies within the state, then under those accounting and reporting standards, the states can essentially opt in to count those emissions. There's no problem with that. If a state, again, this is under accounting guidance for communities, if a community wants to take responsibility, again, not sole responsibility, but some amount of responsibility for emission because it has the authority from an accounting perspective, that's fine.
So I think I'm building off what you just said. If coal goes from Montana to China and China makes a product and that product comes back to Montana and it's consumed in Montana, the assigning responsibility gets complicated.
Right. Yes.
And isn't the coal?
Yes, it can be complicated. It doesn't have to be, but you could apply math to it. You could apply any number of tools to assign responsibility.
And isn't the point of your analysis that governments have control over this, particularly if they have a constitutional duty for a clean and healthful environment?
They have control and influence over greenhouse gas emissions that are both within, that ultimately occur both within and outside their borders, and they can use that authority.
Thank you, sir. No further questions.
I have nothing further, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.